This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm your host, Wayne Barton, author and producer of several Manchester United books and films, joined on this journey, as I always am, by the legendary football writer, Paddy Barclay. We are taking you down this road of Old Trafford history, which has got a very, very bumpy stop in this episode, to say the least, the 1973-1974 season. If you are watching the video, please give us a like and a subscribe to the channel as well, and join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. Paddy, as we take stock of Manchester United's 72-73 season, there was a feeling, the general feeling was that United had got away with one, rather than that it was going to get worse, rather that was as bad, and people, modern listeners might be familiar with this phrase, yeah, that was as bad as it was going to get. They could now turn the tide around.
Yes, yes. I think that was the general feeling. The last vestiges of the heroes of 1968, of that team, last vestiges of that team were sort of almost on the point of being sort of swept out. Yes, there was a feeling that Manchester United was looking forward rather than back. We'll see about that. But I think despite the results, there was a different feeling at Old Trafford from the minute that Tommy Dock had come through the door, really.
Yeah. Certainly at the start of the season, this idea of a new future, obviously the feeling that was exemplified by the departures of Dennis Law and Bobby Charlton, it sort of took a step backwards when George Best returned to the club. George Best, as we discussed in the previous episode, had been missing since December. Yeah. By all accounts, even to George Best standards, he just decided, I'm just going to live life away from football now. So he was in no condition ready to return. In fact, the moment that sparked his return was when he was found in a hospital room by Matt Busby, possibly the last prominent and visual repercussion of a Busby interference here in terms of how it impacted the football pitch. But it was Busby who decided to pull George in and said, what are you doing here? Don't you think you want to give it another go? George was actually suffering from thrombosis, which is deep vein problems that he suffered on a flight, and it got worse while he'd been out in Spain. So he'd come back to Manchester, which is where Busby had gone to see him. He had obviously been indulging in a lifestyle not conducive to professional football. Paddy, obviously, this was reflective of Busby's really close relationship with George, and the paternal instinct was definitely kicking in there, rather than being a genuine case of George is going to come back and wow the crowd. It was putting an arm around him and saying, please pull yourself together kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. I mean, bear in mind that George was young enough to have been turned round career-wise at this stage. Yeah. I mean, how old would he have been at this 25, 26?
26, yeah.
It's incredible. Probably not much more than that. And his talent was so exceptional that Busby was willing to go not just the extra mile, but basically all the way to the moon and back, really. So it was a backward step. But such was the sort of indulgence, love, call it what you will, that Matt extended towards George, that the general sort of move away from the 68 team was allowed to be put in reverse for that. As you rightly said, look, the other two members of the great trio, Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law, had already gone, Law to Manchester City, and Bobby Charlton to become manager of Preston, where, oh, incidentally, another of the Wembley heroes of 68, David Sadler, in November of this season, 73-4, David Sadler, Joe was who'd been completely bombed out by the Doherty regime, joined with great relief Bobby Charlton at Preston North End in November. And that meant that the only ones who remained of the Wembley heroes were goalkeeper Alex Stepney, Brian Kidd, and George remained. And at the end of this season, we're talking about 73-4, it was just Stepney. But anyway, we'll let you tell the story, Wayne.
Kidd had put in transfer requests prior to this because he'd become disgruntled. First of all, I think with O'Farrell bringing in Wyn Davies and Ted McDougall, who incidentally were both now gone. Doherty had seen short shrift with those, and they were gone obviously within months of being signed. Brian Kidd, given this responsibility of goal scoring alongside Lou McCorry, who had struggled early on to meet those goals, they were in front of the creativity of Sammy McElroy and Willie Morgan, and opponents were finding it easier to mark Willie Morgan because Sammy McElroy was still struggling with the effects of his car crash. Obviously, I've worked with him extensively in recent times, and Sammy talked in detail about how, you know, he was still suffering heavily with that. He didn't think he could run, and it was sort of like a trial by execution. The fans were getting on his back, but he knew that he was in no condition to chase balls. You know, there'd be a ball that was bouncing 20 yards away, and at his fittest, he could go for it. A bit in the state that he was in, there was no chance that he could, so he knew that he was holding back. And some could say that about George Best, but I think at the same time, a lot of the younger lads who were there, because like you've said, there was a younger core of players coming in, a lot of them not good enough, but they were obviously idolising George. So when George came back, it's the same. If anyone ever speaks to Lou McCorry about playing with George Best, his memories are always nostalgic and good because he loved the idea of playing with him. But this version of George Best was not anywhere near. Anyway, George comes back, sort of hoisted upon Doherty, rather, and it was to some extent presented as a Doherty master class in pulling him out of our retirement. But obviously it was clear that there was a lot of problems there. United had no attacking presence in the early weeks of the season. Kidd is lost, Morgan's isolated. Kidd actually does well to score two goals early season in a win over West Ham, but that's pretty much the highlight of those early weeks because by mid-October, United have lost 7 of their 12 league games. They failed to score in 5 of them. George, having returned for training, is sort of rushed back into... I mean, what state was this, Paddy? Is it half fitness? I don't even know if you would say that. He'd been in training for 4 or 5 weeks. He'd lost some of the timber that he had on.
Yes.
He was still heavy set when United played against Birmingham. and it was a lot easier to mark for the Birmingham players. To triumph in this game, the sort of the buzz around George being back. But just before we talk about the Birmingham game and the sort of quirk around that, tell us a little bit about the condition that this, the George Best that returned for basically these 12 games. What was this?
I think George was under the impression, whether justifiably or not, after the consultation with Matt, I almost use a medical term advisedly there, but after the agreement that he could come back, I think George was under the impression that, and although we, to an extent you're right about him getting a little, looking a bit more like a footballer, is true. I think George was under the impression that his real obligation was to turn up basically in time for a Friday session and play on a Saturday. Whereas, you know, most footballers look upon it as a 6-day-a-week job, you know? And I think George was under the impression that a special sort of regimen had been created for him. Doherty couldn't put up with that because, after all, as you will know more than anyone, that's how Doherty had got rid of Dennis, you know?
Yeah, he's out there, yeah.
Because he was unable to train. So, George was not in a good condition. George was in the condition of a man 8 or 9 years older than he actually was by then. Yeah. However, you know, he was still George Best. He retained his ability, but he wasn't, we talked a few episodes ago about the young George Best and how he was able to escape, how he was able to hurdle challenges by almost defying gravity and thereby not sustain so many injuries. He was no longer able to do that by now. So the tackles would have been hurting a lot more than they had done before. This was not the man who had tortured Benfica twice. You know, this was not the man who'd bestrode Europe and become almost a world superstar. It was not the same man at all. It was a man sort of beginning to scrape the dregs out of his career.
Yeah, top scorer at this point in the season alongside Brian Kisler. Yeah. Alex Stepney. Stepney had scored a penalty against Leicester City, and then against Birmingham City, Stepney scored a penalty. It was the only goal of the game, so United win the game against fellow strugglers at the bottom there, Birmingham. George does score 2 goals, so he's joint top scorer at Christmas. 2 actually decent goals, but if you watch them back again, the goals against Coventry, against Spurs, they're ones where he's afforded a little bit of space and the magic is in his feet, but it's almost like they've given him the space because he's got the reputation of being George Best, where you can tell the physical condition. If they'd have treated him with the respect of being the old George Best and they tried to fly in on him, they would possibly have got there. Both of those goals come in defeats, which is symbolic of his tenure with United. The temporary high of United winning against Birmingham is tempered by another dismal run. They go on a run of no win and 5 defeats in 9 games. George is trying. He is missing training. And this is, you mentioned about it being a complication of Busby bringing him back and Doherty not quite being prepared for it. For that Dennis Law reason in particular, Tommy's getting aggravated by the fact that George is missing training and he's still picking him to play, And George, when he's there, he's trying his best. He's met them halfway. He's trying to lose a bit of weight, but like we've already mentioned, we've gone over that. He's in no real strong condition. United are getting to December. They're in a real relegation scrap at the bottom of the table. So it's clear that hope that they were going to bounce back from the disappointment of last season, this is the reality for this Manchester United team, unfortunately. Not only is the motivation gone, a lot of these players are just not good enough and they need to start addressing that reality very quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, do United have any good spots at all in the first part of the season? We mentioned the game against West Ham, the quirky win against Birmingham because Stepney scores the penalty.
Yeah,
there is some spirit in some of these kids, which is at least something that's enticing the crowd. Brian Greenough, who's a youngster, has been brought in by Tommy Docherty, who Tommy had previously wanted to sign when he was manager at Rotherham. He gives him his first team bow, and he comes in and he plays. It's funny because Greenough will go on to make his name as an established class A international centre-half, but this early time, not that anyone was ever calling him the next Bobby Charlton, but that was the position that he sort of walked into. He was like, Charlton's vacation in the side was where Greenough came into in defensive midfield. So Greenough and Tony Young score goals to rescue a 2-2 draw against Chelsea early in the season. It's like, oh, there's a little bit of optimism around these kids. But where you've got a Greenough who is good enough, you've got a Tony Young who sadly is not. It gets to the point where United, they play a game on New Year's Day against QPR. United lose 3-0. George Best is kicked all over the place and he goes on a disappearing act to his nightclub, which is called Slack Alice in Manchester. He's featured on front of the newspapers. Why that is important is because a deal has actually been done, which was a story that had never been told to, well, as far as I was aware, it had never been told before. But I told you this story when I was writing True Genius. I think I told you to tell you about it. A story that had never been told before. Because obviously what's about to lead in from this story is that Docherty, there's a famous story about what happened when United were drawn against Plymouth at home in the FA Cup. And these are the series of events that leads to George's permanent exit from United.
Yeah.
What wasn't previously known was that a deal had been done to sell George to QPR. They had a Wheeler dealer chairman, Jim Gregory.
Yes.
They had a conscientious manager, Gordon Jago. Gordon didn't really feel comfortable spending a lot of money. He didn't like taking gambles. He'd taken a gamble with Rodney Marsh. They'd not paid any money for him, but he had to accommodate him in the side. And that had somewhat backfired when Marsh's ego had got sort of too big for his boots and he sort of forced to move to Manchester City, destabilising this great QPR side that Jago was building. When the money came in from that, it was like something like £100,000 for Gordon Jago. Jim Gregory said that Jago could reinvest it, and he confessed to me that he had sleepless nights over doing so, reinvesting the money to strengthen his side. So a little further down the line comes this opportunity to sign George Best. Jim Gregory's made a comment about, well, we'd love to sign him because he'll put an extra 10,000 on the gate, as it has done today for this game, this visit of George Best, even though it's not the same George Best. Docherty realising that that's where some vital funds could come in and knowing that he can't tolerate George Best any longer, agrees to the sale.
Yeah.
So the deal is agreed. And then when the newspapers show pictures of George Best stumbling out of the nightclub, Gordon Jago calls Jim Gregory and says, I can't, with my conscience, I can't sanction this deal. I don't want to sign him. It'll destabilise what we've got. So this is the background between what happens against Plymouth, because the story is that, well, the story told by Docherty was always that George turned up drunk with a woman 20 minutes before kickoff, and that's why he wasn't allowed to play. All of the players have always said that George turned up. He was there for the pre-match meal. No girl, no drink. And George, obviously, when he told that story himself, that's the version that he stuck with. The legend goes, because there's the element of doubt in there, because George was so unpredictable, that was the element that Docherty was sort of playing on, because people wouldn't know either way. The output of this is effectively that George is told that he's not playing in the game. So George says, if I'm not going to play against Plymouth, if I'm not good enough to play against Plymouth, then I'm not good enough to play against anyone. I'm going to leave for good. And then the story is that he goes and never came back. And that was a story that George told. And obviously that's more poetic. It lends itself to storytelling. Yeah. That he just disappeared and never came back. There were reports that week in the newspapers that he did report back for training. And Tommy Kavanagh had been instructed basically to take him away from the first team. Uh-huh. So he wasn't disrupting them. And then obviously a couple of days after that, George realised, I've got no future here. And then he went. Obviously, this time it was kind of clear that it was going to be a final exit. Talk me through, we talked about the reality of Colin's exit and it was sad but inevitable. We talked about the shock of Dennis Law's exit. This was very, I think people had more or less accepted that George was gone and they were more surprised that he'd come back really for 12 games, weren't they? And
yes,
knew that he was gone at this point.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. You see, if Manchester United's support had been confronted with the loss of the George Best of old, the George Best of his early 20s, I would say, the best player in the Ballon d'Or winner. If they'd been confronted with the loss of that George Best, there would have been, there would have been people throwing themselves off the cantilever stand. I mean, it would have caused shock and dismay and sadness, grief. But that wasn't what they were losing. They were losing a clearly diminished, unfit, troubled figure who, how many goals in the season?
Two.
Right, okay. That's, half a season, admittedly. Yeah. But, you know, that's up to four in a whole season. And that, you know, George Best, you know, would score 24 or 34 in a season, you know, at his peak. So they just weren't losing the George Best of old. So there was a complete acceptance. I don't remember any sort of regret other than a sadness that the career looked to be petering out 5 years too soon.
Yeah, George was gone. And I know we've dwelled a lot upon George Best, but I think it was worth it. We're talking about really one of the premier talents, and it's a cigarette card, isn't it, between where you're establishing United's top three players of all time. I would probably have him as number one because of his talent. In most of those 474 games that he played for United, he was... We could say maybe 400 of those. He was
in terms of basic talent, I never saw Duncan Edwards, but I would say he was probably the most talented footballer. Never mind Manchester United, never mind the United Kingdom. I would say he was probably the most talented player I ever saw in the flesh. Maybe slightly more talented than the best player that I ever saw, who was Diego Maradona.
Yeah.
And Diego Maradona was a better player than George because he was more of a team player. If you look at, you know, what he did for ordinary Argentine teams, he actually compares well with Messi in that sense as a leader. George was not a leader. But in terms of basic talent, there's nobody that I've seen, and I'm nearly 75, there's nobody I've seen in my lifetime in the flesh who George Best would compare unfavorably with anywhere in the world. Now, whether that makes him Manchester United's greatest ever player is, you've got to factor in a couple of points here. One, Duncan Edwards will loom large over any discussion of United's greatest ever player. And people, you know, who saw him, including Wilf McGuinness, who played alongside him, said he was the greatest. Bobby Charlton, I think we've mentioned this in the series before, said he was the only player that made him, Bobby, feel inferior. And again, that's quite a statement, since, you know, Bobby Charlton would be in any envelope for greatest Manchester United players. So it's a matter of taste, I suppose. The most entertaining player, I thought, was George. The one who put 10,000... Dennis and Bobby were much better team players.
Yeah.
I mean, especially Dennis. But Oh, I don't know. As you say, it's a cigarette vapor among the lot of the man Duncan Edwards. Would there be anybody else? In
Ronaldo, in Ronaldo, modern.
Oh players. Yes, Ronaldo. Yes, definitely. I mean, Ronaldo was the opposite of George in that he applied himself to the, you know, beyond 100%. If that doesn't sound too silly a piece of football ease. You know, if George was, you know, underachieved for his talent, you know, it's difficult to see what more Cristiano Ronaldo could have done. But did he have as much natural ability as George? I would say possibly slightly less, though he made much more of himself. And that therefore, yes, you would have to put him in. So that's five of the greatest players. I don't think Rooney's quite. Rooney would be in the next grade down, in my opinion.
You would put Best and Cantona in a category where they made the impossible possible.
I would put Cantona in a complete class of his own, because what he did was all to use the word that Gary Neville used in when the 1999 team came back to win in Barcelona. Cantona was supernatural, or seemed to be supernatural, in the alchemy that he could complete, you know, the effect he had on the team. Was he up there with Lord Best Charlton and Ronaldo and Edwards in terms of ability? I would say no. But was he up in terms with them in effect? I would say he probably had more effect on the history of Manchester United than anyone except Edwards.
It's a really compelling argument. But in terms of natural ability, sorcery, certainly at this point, George stood alone. You've never seen anything like the things that we've talked through, many of them, scoring from corner kicks, running through space that wasn't there against Benfica and stuff like that. This wasn't that version of George, and George was gone. And United struggled towards the end of the season. In George's absence, a player, Jim McAlliog, was signed. United, pretty much, there was a home defeat against Leeds, which got a really good attendance, 60,000 supporters. But United were, at that point, once they'd lost that game, sort of really feeling like they were doomed to relegation.
That would have been because Leeds was, to an extent, always will be a local derby for United. Like Liverpool, it has that, you know, teeth on edge quality, hasn't it? Is that why there was such a huge crowd for that?
Well, yeah, they were. I mean, I'm looking through the attendances either side of it were 40,000, and then they did register a low of 33,000 a few weeks later against Burnley for a 3-3 draw. But the crowds hadn't really turned their back on. We'd seen drops, and certainly overall, I think there's a 5,000 on average drop this season. Yeah. But they haven't left in their masses, which tells you a lot.
For a team that's you know, not finding the net, it's not bad that as a fall, is it? It's not bad.
They certainly were not finding the net. Yeah, they weren't. And there was a game at Birmingham where they played, in these days they were called relegation four-pointers. In the middle of March, Birmingham were playing, obviously, at St. Andrews. United felt that they'd cleared their lines. They hit a clearance. It hit a Birmingham player and flew straight into the back of United's net when your luck is not in. And if you are listening to that and thinking, that is a freak occurrence that could never happen in a million years. First of all, yes, it did. Second of all, the exact same sequence happened in 1992 when United played at West Ham and Gary Pallister tried to clear it and it hit the West Ham and flew back in and cost us the title. So United have suffered that exact goal twice in their history. So they were doomed to almost certain relegation from this point. It was unthinkable. wanting to take a little bit of pressure from the young players. Doherty signs Jim McAuliffe, who is an experienced Wolves forward, a little bit in style similar to Gerry Daly, who's been playing in this season, in the languid forwards. They can move into good spaces. He's definitely not prolific by any stretch of the imagination, McAuliffe or Daly for that matter. But the experience of McAuliffe lifts a lot of pressure from these youngsters. United were still trying to play decent football. Doherty had them trying to pass and move.
Yes.
Try and do that. And then, Paddy, for a bizarre two-week period, United played well and won four games from five, a couple of them against...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Relegation strugglers, winning down at Norwich in particular, inspired by the introduction of McAuliffe. Did it seem as if the improbable was on that United might be able to get out of it?
Yeah, there was a spark of hope during that period. From my recollection, there was always under Doherty a feeling that they were trying to play the right way. You know, that they were trying to entertain, that they were trying to achieve a bit of enjoyment. And my recollection again is that you mentioned Gerry Daly. Quite rightly, you mentioned McAuliffe. I think Daly's a very underrated player.
Yeah,
I loved watching Gerry Daly. He could pass a football. He could play. He could. And he could run a bit. He was a very lean. I was going to say understated, possibly a little bit understated, but my word, I think he could play. And I think when people like him and McAuliffe were on the ball, you could see a bit of the football coming back. Despite the fact, I mean, results weren't reflecting it, apart from in the period you're talking about when they did. Was it three wins? Four and five, right. So it was that was a decent spell. That's the kind of thing that, you know, fight backs against relegation are built on. It wasn't a completely barren season. And I think that's probably why the gap, the fall in attendance was 10%, maybe something like that, rather than more.
Yeah, United, after this mini run, it concludes with a 3-0 win over Everton. They go to Southampton, they take the lead. Southampton strugglers as well. They take the lead through a penalty, and then Southampton come back with their goal's slightly fortuitous, but they get a draw, and United start to feel the players are a bit gutted by that because they felt the wind had gone from the sails. They were so looking forward to, they were obviously looking forward to holding on to the win, but they knew that they needed to in order to sort of get that another four-pointer against a vital rival down there. They play at Everton, it's a weird game because at half-time, United are holding their own. They're having a tough game. Everton, obviously, given as good as they get at Goodison Park.
Yeah.
But at half-time, the scores are read out and all United's results are going against them. And Doherty is furious after the game. He's furious that they did that. I mean, it was, you know, slightly common practice. It wasn't uncommon for scores to be read out at half-time. But I think Doherty just feeling that he needed everything to go in his favour. And this sort of turned against him. The lads, their confidence were on the floor and they lose the game. And it means it leads to this situation where they play Manchester City at home. And it means if they don't win, they're likely to go down. Results against them as well. Results need to go for them. And they still need to win against Manchester City. It's one of the most infamous Manchester cities, Manchester derbies in history, Paddy. And I think even though with City's recent resurgence and the takeover, and every year you would get, this is the most important Manchester derby of all time. This is the most important in terms of symbolic. And I say this as a Manchester United fan, and we know the technicality of this. Spoiler, Dennis Law scores, Manchester United are relegated. Yes. We know the reality is Dennis Law's goal didn't relegate Manchester United, but in terms of symbolism, it might as well have done. Because
it will always be remembered as that. I mean, we can all picture the Dennis Law's apologetic. Look at that. He's being consoled by Mike Summerby after scoring a goal because he looks so distraught. He almost apologizes rather than celebrates. And is that fans going? Is that City fans? I mean, we've got a picture up on the screen here. Is that United fans saying, "Don't worry, Dennis, you're still the king"?
Yeah, pretty much.
But in actual fact, that wasn't the goal that in reality it symbolically sent. It was the, you know, an extra nail in the coffin, I suppose. It is said, I think, by Everton fans that it was actually Mick Lyons in that Everton match who scored the goal that sent United down.
Yeah.
So, no, it wasn't Dennis, but I suppose it's certainly the most enduring myths in Mancunian football. And it's interesting that if Dennis had felt any temptation to celebrate inwardly in the sense of take that, Doherty, you know, that'll teach you to free me without telling me first, you know. He certainly hid it out of respect for the support and out of respect for his own feelings for Manchester United.
The goal as well, by the way. United have huffed and puffed.
It was a very good finish, wasn't it? It was almost as if no pressure, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Back heel, slips through Stepney's hands. The kind of ingenuity that United fans have cheered for many years.
Yeah.
The kind of goal that really only Dennis Law scored. We talked about the brilliance of George Best, but Law was equally adept. The way that his sort of range of finishing in the box was unlike anybody else's, and you know, United found that out to their cost on that occasion. Immediately from that, he trudged off the pitch. He was going to be substituted, but the fans invaded the pitch, as we saw from the images, and they caused the referee to sort of call an end to the game. So it was basically Dennis Law's last act in domestic football. He walked to the United dressing room, where Jim McCalliog found him after with his head in his hands. And he famously, obviously, never talked about that goal until we did the film, you know, Too Good To Go Down. It was strange, a very surreal moment, because obviously I've grown up with knowing that Dennis Law never talked about the goal. Mm-hmm. And then we were just in conversation, because I was doing the interviewing for it. And we were just in conversation. I just sort of not prompted it, because I didn't want to be, you know, when you're, We historically he's never talked about it. I didn't want to.
Yeah, you didn't want to push it. Yeah,
but I don't even remember what it was that I said to him that prompted him to actually talk about it. But he did. He sort of said a few words for it. I remember when the film aired, getting half a dozen phone calls and messages like saying, "You got Dennis Law to talk about it." I said, "No, Dennis talks of his own accord." But obviously, that was a massive privilege that he did that, to be trusted to be able to sort of do it in a faithful way, because obviously, telling that story of United going down isn't one that many people would be thrilled with, but obviously he was great for that, you know. And obviously it was a very, very symbolic moment, and try as people might to paint a different picture or to build a game up, it still feels, I know Wayne Rooney's goal in 2011, the overhead kick, which was possibly the best ever Manchester derby goal, even that I don't think compares to the symbolism of what Dennis Law did on that day. It was such a seismic moment, and then United were relegated to Division Two. They lost the last three games 1-0. That was the second of them. Obviously, the Goodison Park won the first, losing to Stoke in the last game. Mm. That made it. I think it's eight 1-0 defeats over the season in the league. 48 goals conceded in 42 games, which particularly rankles with Alex Stepney because his form had held up. He'd been good enough. Early elimination in both cups to make it a very, very miserable season for Tommy Docherty. He expected to be sacked, Paddy, but he was instead presented with a case of champagne by Matt Busby. It's such an odd gesture. Obviously, very, very sporting of Matt to do that, and it's a magnificent show of faith, but it's such an odd gesture, isn't it?
A case of champagne. It is odd. It sounds a bit more Louis Edwards than Matt Busby, but anyway, yeah. If Matt did that, then that's fine. I wasn't aware of that story, but I think it was a sign that, a little bit like, what was the year? You'll be able to tell me straight away. 1991, two was it? When United ended up winning the FA Cup. 89-90, that's right. When Martin Edwards, to this day, insists that Ferguson's job was not in danger, and if Mark Robbins hadn't scored the goal at Nottingham and if United hadn't survived the other tough cup ties and ended up winning even in the final, they needed a replay, winning the cup, that Alex Ferguson's job was not in danger because they could feel the undercurrent of health at the club, you know, particularly in youth development and so on. I think there was a similar sense, maybe not quite so dramatic, that was reflected in Matt Busby's giving that present to, because you don't give a case of champagne to a guy then sack him. So it was perhaps that was the intention behind it, to say, listen, we know, you know, the fans don't want to go down. The club doesn't want to go down. The players don't want to go down, but we know that we're in safe hands and that we'll come up. And in fact, the they sometimes say of clubs that are in trouble, what you really need is to go down, go to the second division, rediscover your style, reset, as the word is now, and come back stronger. Well, for a lot of teams have found out that it's not that easy. But, well, again, no spoilers, but my forecast is that our next episode's going to show that Manchester United can handle second division football pretty well.
Yeah, you're probably right. It was probably Busby via Louis Edwards. That case of champagne was delivered because it was the Edwards style, and they would have definitely had that conversation. But Busby,
maybe Louis had to write out the check. Yeah,
yeah, possibly. Which, considering the way that Docky would in later episodes, as we'll come to discover, complain about the check writing skills of Busby and Edwards, perhaps he would have given that case of champagne, Mike, if he'd have known. Well, let's go on to the squad stats for this very, very dismal season. I'll put Brian Greenough up first of all, but I'll go through the goalkeepers. Alex Stepney was the only goalkeeper this season, 45 games and 2 goals, which is going to be a very strange thing for a goalkeeper. 42 league games and 2 goals.
Not a bad return for a keeper.
No, it's pretty good. Didn't end the season as top scorer. We'll get to that in a little while. The defenders, Martin Buchan was ever present with 45 games. No goals for him this season. Brian Greenough, nominally a defender, but also a midfielder as well. He played mostly in midfield this season, but because he's on the screen, I'll talk about him. He scored 3 goals in his first season, 36 games. He played in the league, and all of those goals came in the league as well. He was a young player from Barnsley, like I said. Tommy Docherty had wanted to get him when he was at Rotherham. I think the first thing he said, he was one of the first players that he approached when he arrived at United and said, I wanted to get you, and I finally got you now. He gave Brian his debut. Brian was a ball-playing defensive midfielder. He had very good positional intelligence. He was a very fine reader of the game. And he was the brightest, form was the brightest spot in this season, as he would be awarded the club's Player of the Season award. Jim Holton, very popular as well. He scored 2 goals in 37 games, 34 appearances in the league. Alex Forsyth, we mentioned in the previous episode, he made 21 appearances, 19 of those, sorry, in the league, and he scored a single goal. I think he did. No, he did not. I can't find. Oh, he did. He scored in the game against Burnley in the last stages of the season. Brings us on to, there was actually a few defenders given bows this season. Clive Griffiths. And you'll notice when we do the player picks, we do try where possible to get a picture of Clive, a picture of that player when they were at United, preferably from the season in which we're referencing. Clive Griffiths, is impossible to find a picture of him. You know, this is from his NASL games. He made just 7 appearances for the club, and they were all this season. He was a centre-back. He could play in various central, various defensive positions, but he played as a centre-back for United, a Welsh lad, and these were his only appearances for the club. He remained with the club after this season, though, for another couple of years, I think 1976, signed by Chicago Sting, who were managed by Bill Foulkes. And I mentioned Clive only because that's him, only going on a little bit too much about a player who played only 7 times for United. Did want to pay tribute to the fact that he beat cancer twice. The first time was actually in the 1980s, and he remarkably played while receiving chemotherapy, which shows you a lot about his... And the other defenders, you mentioned David Sadler. He made only 3 appearances in the league this season before he left. So those were his final 3 appearances for the club. 2 of those were starts and 1 as a sub appearance. Arnie Sidebottom, we mentioned in a previous episode, just 2 appearances this season. Tony Young, we mentioned his goal against Chelsea. He made 32 appearances and scored that single goal. 29 of those were in the league. Steve James, we've mentioned him. He was a regular defender this season. 2 goals in 23 games, 21 of those in the league. And it brings us to the last defender on this list, which is Stuart Houston. He was signed in the early reaches of this season. He would be a future Scottish international, captain in the future. Strangely enough, he only received 1 cap. And it sort of ties into this feeling that Stuart Houston is very, very undervalued. Or very underappreciated, because he was known to Doherty from Chelsea before he went to Brentford, which is where United signed him from. United acquired him only 55,000. He'd gone to play. Look at the number of games he played for United. Tell me a little bit about Stuart Houston. I mean, resolute, consistent, rarely beaten, definitely credit.
Good tackler. And in fact, you know, we've not really talked about the defence. We've talked about the attack, finding it hard to score goals. But the fact that United conceded only just over 1 goal per match in a relegation season says a lot for the defence. And Stuart Houston, who I think would have been, most of his appearances would have been at left back, Holton and Buchan, and if not James and Buchan, were particularly though Holton and Buchan were a very good centre-back partnership. Right back would be either Forsyth or Tony Young, maybe.
Yeah, Young in this team.
And with Houston at left back, that's definitely not what would now be called a championship back four. That's a premier back four. So I think it could have been even worse this 73-4 season had United not had. Well, you've also mentioned that Stepney had a good season. So the defence, actually, without, you know, a reasonably solid defence, United would have probably been relegated by Easter. So it was, there were bright sparks. And you know, with a back four like that, especially with the age range of them, I mean, Buchan's still fairly young, still plenty of years in him. Ditto Holton, ditto Houston, I would say. What would Houston have, how old would he have been at this, at 28?
Let's just get this up. 20, 24,
24. Right. So he's got loads. And Alex Forsyth, you know. So but whether Alex Forsyth, you know, hits the heights is another matter. But, you know, there's hope there. That there's the basis of a sound defence for what's going to be a second-tier campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. Move on to the midfield. George Best, 2 goals in those 12 games, all of them in the league before he departed. George Graham, obviously captain of the side, but soon to be dethroned from his captaincy. 26 appearances in all competitions, 24 of those in the league, as you can see, growing out of favour already. A single goal in the league. Mick Martin, who obviously made his bow in the previous season, 18 appearances in all competitions, 16 of those in the league. Sammy McElroy, who wins joint top scorer this season, 6 goals in 31 games in all competitions, 29 of those in the league, and all of his goals came in the league as well. Trevor Anderson, who we mentioned in the previous episode, or in previous episodes, he made 12 appearances and scored a single goal in the league. Brings us on to the other midfielders, Paul Bielby, Darlington-born forward midfielder, left-sided midfielder. He was one of the young forwards given a chance with United in when they were needing goals at the end of the season, and Docky was ringing the changes trying to get them. He made only these 4 appearances for the club. Sorry, it looks a little bit missed on the screen. Paul Bielby, forward, that's what he's meant to say there. 4 appearances, no goals. He would have a decent career with Hartlepool and Huddersfield, and he actually in later life received an MBE for services to youth football. I think he still runs if he's retired, the academy still exists with his name in there, so he still runs that in the Northeast. Definitely a player who has some distinction, who left Manchester United, if not with distinction while he was at Manchester United. Jerry Daler, as we mentioned, not only a favourite of Paddy, a favourite on the Old Trafford Terrace, they instantly loved his style. He scored in this season just a single goal in 17 appearances in all competitions, 16 of those in the league. And brings us to Jim McCalliog, who we mentioned earlier on. Jim, from Wolves United, signed him. He was a Scottish international, famously scored at Wembley, right, Paddy? Was that the win which dethroned England as world champion?
Yes, it was when we became world champions, 1967, 1 year after England had beaten Germany in the World Cup final. Yes, he was one of the heroes of that day, and as you rightly say, he scored a goal.
Yeah, and he was very influential in United's upturn in form, brought a lot of confidence in the players and made them believe that they could play a little bit better football. Not exactly Jimmy Greenough or Eric Cantona in terms of catalyst, but a little catalyst nonetheless. And a very, very nice man as well, Jim McCalliog. He's a very nice man. He had bags of experience and United needed that, and that was going to be crucial for United in the second tier. For sure, their attacking options are very, very, very sparse. Lou McCorry scored 6 goals in 38 games, 5 in 35 in the league. Brian Kidd, who scored those 2 goals against West Ham, they were the only goals he scored all season. 24 appearances, 21 in the league. And he would have enough of trying to impress at United, and he would finally be granted his exit this time round. As you mentioned, only Alex Stemme from the European Cup side would remain. Willie Morgan, 2 goals in 44 appearances in all competitions, 41 in the league. Story Moore, we already mentioned his injury problems, which were starting to cripple his career. He made only 2 appearances this season and scored a single goal. Peter Fletcher, we mentioned in the previous episode, who had made just 5 appearances this season, none of them resulting in a goal, all of them in the league. And that brings us on to the last player for this list, and his name is George Buchan, brother of Martin Buchan, also of Aberdeen history, but era where the similarities end. He was fair-haired and a forward, and he's also got a big beaming smile. I'm not saying Martin Buchan doesn't smile, he's a very joyous guy. You would see pictures of him looking decidedly more serious than what George is looking on this picture. Yep. And not as ever-present as Martin, that's for sure. He made only 4 substitute appearances for the United first team. He didn't make much of an impression. He actually ended up playing semi-professional while working as a school teacher in Oldham. So he remained in the Northwest near his brother. But yeah, he was one of a number of these players who were tried. A few of them managing to register goals. United struggling a lot with the weight of expectation that came on a lot of these young players, like a Gerry Daly, like a Sammy McElroy, like Lou McCaughrey, like Brian Kidd, really, was being tasked with the task that George Best didn't want. He had to lead this United side and just couldn't do it. The side, I don't have a graphic for this, but the 4-2-4 or 4-4-2 United played this season would read Stepney in goal, Forsyth, or most likely Tony Young at right back. You mentioned Buchan, Holland, Houston in the defence to round off that 4. The midfield would usually read something like Morgan, Graham, Greenough, McElroy. If not McElroy, then Daly, as McElroy was beginning to find his fitness. In the front 2, McCaughrey and Kidd, although it wasn't really a team throughout the 11 that really struck any kind of physical prowess, apart from Holton and Houston, who were finally beginning to add a little bit of steel at the back there. I mean, United's colours hadn't changed this season. They were red, white and black in the home colours. The away strip was all white. And the third kit was that beautiful, beautiful yellow shirt, which, if we just pop it back up for Brian's thing, that's the shirt there, that yellow shirt that United certainly did not play like Brazil in this season. That's for sure, they did not. The average attendance was 41,251, which was down 5,000. The top goal scorers, you would have heard it there, 6 goals, McElroy and McCaughrey sharing that, finished 21st in the league. So even though the league extended the relegation spots, they would have still gone down because they went down in the second relegation spot, not the last one. And the key results this season were the Birmingham defeat, the freak defeat, where the goal flew in off the clearance. And then obviously the Manchester City result, because you can't get away from that. It was a very, very symbolic result. Elsewhere in football, Paddy, well, a lot of managerial shake-up in the postseason for this. Leeds win the league, Liverpool win their only their second FA Cup, and Wolves win the League Cup, but it's off the pitch where everything's moving because Alf Ramsey gets sacked midway through the season, and that prompts the end of the Don Revie era at Leeds because he becomes England manager, which prompts the end of the Brian Clough era at Derby because he steps into the breach at Leeds without Peter Taylor, demonstrating the value of a good assistant and how difficult it is to take a job with such a determined structure as Leeds had with Riva. And Bill Shankly retired. Did it feel at that time like it was one of the biggest shifts in recent football history for all this change to be happening?
Yes. Because, I mean, after all, these people all changed the history of their clubs. Or in Alf's case, their countries. Shankly was made Liverpool more successful than ever before. Ditto Revie at Leeds, you know. So, yes, there was a feeling that would we ever see the like again, and I wonder if. If we do, if people would be given the time at their clubs, I mean, I have to stress that they turn things around pretty quickly. I mean, more quickly than Ferguson did at United, but I wonder if such men exist, such creatures. I wonder if the managers are able to wield such power at a Premier League club as these guys did in remoulding Leeds, Liverpool, and of course before that, Busby at Manchester United.
Yeah, it's been a difficult time. If you've been watching this podcast and you've seen the decline of Manchester United, don't worry too much because we've just seen Shankly retired. He's being succeeded by an assistant, Bob Paisley, and announced transition. We know how badly they go. So obviously in the next few episodes, we'll be talking about the obvious decline of Liverpool into the second division while United flourish. I'm sure that will be the case. But that's it for this episode. United relegated to the second division. They definitely were not too good to go down. We will be back next time to discuss their trip in the second division. If you've enjoyed watching this video, please give it a like and subscribe. Join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe, listen, give us a review on the platform you're listening on as well. We really appreciate that. We will be back next time to talk about United in...
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.